I want to welcome you to our program tonight. We are going to get started, I think. Thank you very much for being here. My name is Hayden Anderson. I'm Executive Director of the Maine Humanities Council. I want to thank our partners for this program. We have two fantastic partners. The Portland Public Library, Sarah and her gang, have just been so helpful and supportive in bringing this together. I think you all probably know this because you're here tonight, but the Portland Public Library is just an absolute gem for the city. And I'm not talking about the building, but the institution and the people and the energy and all the stuff that's going on here. So, yeah. So we are very, very proud to be in partnership with Portland Public Library on this program. And also our good friends at the Maine Historical Society, right up here on Congress Street. The Maine Historical Society just, I think last Friday, opened this great big and wonderful exhibition. I went and saw it this afternoon on 400 years of immigration to Maine. And it's actually bigger in scope than that. I think they were being a little bit modest. As I was looking through today, that exhibit spans from 13,000 years ago to the middle of last week. It's really quite a piece of work and shows really important snippets of immigration to Maine over all those years. So I really, really would encourage you to get up the street to that exhibit. Okay, so for those of you who are not familiar with the Maine Humanities Council, we are the State of Maine affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Library of Congress Center for the Book. Our vision at the Maine Humanities Council is to see the communities of Maine transformed by the power and pleasure of ideas. And every single day we put on our neckties, we come to the office in pursuit of that vision. A lot of that work is events like this one this evening, where the idea is to get Mainers together and to share information, to share conversation, to think together and talk together about matters of civic importance. That's what we're doing here tonight. I know that in recent weeks and months, there's been a lot in the news, locally and nationally, about refugees, globally, about refugees. There's been lots and lots of public conversation about it. I think that there is room for intelligent people of goodwill to disagree about policies and practices on refugees. But unfortunately, I think a lot of times those conversations have been kicking off more heat than they have light. And I think it's unfortunate, and that's really what we're trying to do here tonight, is to do our modest part to try to shed some light on this topic. So the format tonight, we have three panelists whom I'm going to introduce in a moment. The idea is that for about an hour or so, we will have a conversation up here. And then in about an hour or so, we'll open it up for comments and questions from the audience. So that's the plan, if that sounds okay. And the parking ban does not start until 10 p.m., as I understand it. And so everybody is cool no matter where you parked, as long as you paid the meter. Okay, so here are our panelists tonight. Our goal in recruiting panelists was to get as much expertise and as much knowledge and as much experience as we possibly could up on this stage when it comes to the systems around refugees and asylum seekers. And I don't want to pat us on the back too much, but when I look at these panelists, I think we accomplished that. Sally Blauvelt, in the center here, is the field office director for the Portland Field Office of the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services. That's the federal agency that oversees immigration in the United States. She's worked with USCIS and its predecessor agency in various roles since 1996. That is a long time now, Sally. So included in her service with USCIS, in the late 90s, in 1999, she did a detail in Africa, East and West Africa, to determine eligibility for refugee status for people from Somalia, Nigeria, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. In the early 90s, she worked overseas for the United Nations High Commission on Refugees in Malaysia and Hong Kong. And way back in the mid-80s, she was a Peace Corps volunteer in Kenya. Our second panelist, Amadov, is the Program Manager for Refugee and Immigration Services at Catholic Charities of Maine. He's served in that role at Catholic Charities for more than a dozen years, and he supervises the Office of Refugee Resettlement here in the state of Maine, which we're going to hear much more about. And if I have my facts straight, Tarlin, you speak six languages. Tarlin speaks English, Russian, Turkish, Azerbaijani, Persian, and Turkoman. And he holds a Master of Arts degree in history, good humanities degree from Baku State University. And finally, Barbara Taylor is senior staff attorney for the Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project right here in Portland. She's been practicing law at ILAP since 2006. She is a graduate of the University of Maine School of Law, where she graduated cum laude in 2005. And Barbara also has a master's degree from the Columbia University Teachers College. Before making the switch to a career in the law, Barbara was a teacher and educator in all kinds of different settings. I'm very glad to have the three of you here. I'm really looking forward to this conversation, and I want to get started. And Sally, I want to start with you. So we hear the word refugee is around a lot lately. If you weren't careful, you would think the word refugee means unlucky person from bad place.
Not a bad summary.
But I take it there's more to it than that. What's a refugee?
Broadly speaking, a refugee is a human being or human beings who have been uprooted from their homes and their communities and compelled to flee their national borders as a result of events or events that cause them to be in fear for their safety and their lives. So that's broadly speaking what a refugee is. Now, once these refugee movements flow out of their national borders, there is an international body that's responsible for monitoring, protecting, overseeing, managing these refugee populations in these countries that they've fled to, and that's the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. Now, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and I'll say UNHCR because it's easier for me to do, UNHCR estimates that presently there are approximately or upwards of 20 million refugees worldwide, and I think that's really important to note. So I think it's also important to note that this 20 million number does not include internally displaced populations. If you count that population in the world, you're going to double. There's probably about 40 million displaced people, internally displaced people.
So 40 million displaced people, 20 million who have been forced out of their country of origin.
Right.
And a certain number of subset of those get designated for resettlement as refugees.
Right. So what UNHCR will typically do is, based on a lot of different factors and criteria, will sort of generally determine the what they call durable solution for a refugee population. So the durable solution could be temporary or permanent resettlement in that first country of asylum. It could be eventual repatriation to their home countries when things become more peaceful, or it can be resettlement. Now, of the 20 million people who are currently refugees, UNHCR estimates that 1% of those people are actually resettled, which is, as you can imagine, a very, very small number. And that resettlement is typically going to be in one of the big three countries of the United States, Australia, and Canada. And so UNHCR, and stop me if I'm...
No.
UNHCR, what UNHCR will do is they will then refer refugees whose durable solution is resettlement to the countries who are offering up that resettlement of those refugees. And so the United States every year will get together, led by the State Department, which Tarlin will talk about a little bit later, and in consultation with other departments within the United States and the international community, determine how many refugees that they will accept. And for us, for the next fiscal year, we've determined that we will accept 85,000 refugees into the United States.
I'm just curious. I know that one danger tonight is that I think there are enough details that we could bury ourselves. We could build a fort out of them pretty quickly and not find our way out. But what are some of the criteria that would that an individual or family would have to satisfy for the durable solution for them to be permanent resettlement?
Very briefly, it would be UNHCR's determination of the most vulnerable populations. And once they have determined that, then the people who have been referred for resettlement need to meet the legal definition of refugee, the internationally agreed upon definition of what a refugee actually is. And this is a definition that the United States has also agreed to, which is they need to demonstrate they have a well-founded fear of persecution on account of their race, religion, nationality, political opinion, and membership in a particular social group. And that is the legal definition by which U.S. refugee officers will go into these refugee environment settings, interview this population to see if they're eligible for resettlement.
And so it's not just that a person is in danger of serious harm, but in danger of serious harm by virtue of satisfying one of these five conditions. So 85,000 is the number for next year. Who decides where within the United States refugees will be resettled?
I think Tarlin would probably be in the best position to answer that question.
State Department. State Department, as you know, as just Salah mentioned, they are taking directives from the Congress and presidents every year on October 1st, and they have every week a special meeting for allocation of the refugees. So when they are actually approved by the USCIS to be resettled in the United States, so the State Department make decision with the nine national entities. It's a nonprofit organization based on their religion. For example, one of the Catholic networks, another the Lutheran services, Jewish family services, and etc. There is nine entities, and they make decision which state will get how many refugees. But even prior to that, the State Department makes every year research and abstract research with the refugee resettlement sites and make determination how many refugees will go each of the states. They look at the school, they look at the hospitals, they look at the employment rates and unemployment rates, the housing, and etc. And they make decision on that level. For example, Maine will get 425 individuals for the fiscal year of 16. California gets 10,000 people, and et cetera, et cetera. Then they are making this decision on every week meetings in State Department, and each of the state will get, you know, the allocations. We do not directly participate. Our affiliates in the D.C., they make these decisions together.
But so that's a pretty fine-grained decision-making process.
Yes. I was at one of these meetings. I was just observing, and it's just really amazing how it was done. It's just so many thousands of names and peoples and cases, and they make decisions by the state, by the what is their, if the refugee has any family members already living in that state, they have to go over there. But if they have no one in the states, they will be allocated by the State Department's decision. So they have no choice to go any of the states.
Thank you. Sally, I want to ask you about the work earlier in your career overseas. We're going to hear even more from Tarlin in a minute about sort of at the individual level, the working through the refugee system once a person or a family arrives here in Maine, what should we know about the way the UNHCR does this? What is it like to do that work in a refugee camp in Africa?
Well, it's it has informed my life. It's you know, working in a refugee camp and interviewing, you know, refugees from all over the world. I feel like I have a really good idea of precisely man's inhumanity to man, and it would be it would be difficult to conjure up just how inhumane we can be to one another. So I think that's what I learned in the refugee camps. But having said that, though, working with these refugees, interviewing these refugees, understanding what their narratives were, I also feel like I've been honored to understand better, you know, what human resiliency actually, you know, is through the eyes of these refugees who have great despair but also incredible hope. And so for me, I've always felt really honored to be a participant in the dignity with which these refugees will describe their tragic narratives to me, in a setting where they're exceedingly vulnerable and entirely dependent on me for the decision-making process. That's been, and so for me, a refugee deserves, based on the experience that I've had with these refugees from all over the world, they deserve nothing more from me than, you know, my respect and my compassion. And I really feel like our own humanity can be measured directly on the care that we and the compassion that we show to these very vulnerable populations.
If there were one misconception about the refugee process or your work within this over the course of your career, what that you could dispel that misconception, what would it be? If there were one, here's your shot.
Just one?
Yep, just one.
Can I have two?
Yes, you can have two.
Well, I guess the first thing is that refugees are people who terrible things have happened to and not because of. So if there's any misconception out there around that, then that's what I would like to have dispelled. And then I think the second one is any misconception that refugees would be nothing but a valuable addition to our nation is a misconception that I would also like to dispel if I could.
Thank you very much. We will have time to come back to Sally, but for the moment I want to move to you, Tarlan, and to get a little bit more of a sense of how this system works here in Maine. First, though, I want to ask you, Sally is an employee of the federal government. You are not an employee of the federal government. What is the relationship between Catholic Charities of Maine and the refugee process?
Because I'm a historian, I would like to talk about history of the immigration, because it's really important to understand this in this whole concept, in historical, you know. United States, as you know, it's a country of the immigrants, and based on that, our country has been developed. And the 20th century is very interesting if you look like about the refugees that have been coming here and immigrants. Just two world wars produced millions of the refugees in the world. And of course, the first respondent or responses came from the church. And Catholic Church actually played a huge role in the whole support of the refugees in the beginning of the 20th century, in the 1940s and 1945. Until 1980, the U.S. government never had any Refugee Act or any special, you know, the legislation. In 1980, the U.S. Congress adopted a new Refugee Act, which has really explained a lot of the role of the government itself and how they will work with the nation to resettle refugees. And of course, it was, as you know, 1975 to 1980s, it's a wave of the refugees from Cambodia, from Vietnam, from Southeastern Asia, and then the refugees from former Soviet, you know, from Soviet Union at that time. And the Lautenberg Amendment allowed the Russian Jew and several minorities, religious minorities from Soviet Union and then from Iran to come here. And then Catholic Charities of Maine started to this program in 1975. So actually last year it was the 40th anniversary of having the refugee resettlement program here. So Catholic Charities of Maine is a non-profit organization. It is not religious, you know, per se, but it was built on or inspired by the teaching of the Christ, of Catholic teaching, and we provide services regardless of the faith to every resettled refugees or, you know, the, all the clans that we are serving. It's thousands of people that we serve as a social enterprise in the state of Maine, and we are the one of the largest enterprise. We hired over 600 employees to provide the services. So the refugee program is one of the 20, some eight programs that we have, and we are concentrated on focusing on supporting refugees. So we are one of the part of this Catholic network that is a part of the United States Catholic Bishops Conference that is actually having 128 refugees resettlement sites all over the United States. But in Portland, I mean in Maine, it is only a refugee resettlement office that we are having under the Catholic Charities. So we do not, I mean, have direct, you know, the our the contracts with the State Department, but the USCCB, which is, I just explained, the Catholic Bishops Conference, they have this the contract, and we are subcontracting with them.
So when refugees come to Maine, they are coming through the work of Catholic Charities of Maine? Or you work with all the refugees who...
Yeah, with all the refugees who is allocated with the state of Maine. So the State Department make decision how many refugees will come to the state of Maine, and we have these numbers coming through the USCCB.
And you mentioned before what the number is for fiscal year 2016. Can you give us a sense how many refugees are in Maine?
I believe we had over 18,000 for the last 40 years. They've been resettled, and maybe about 30,000 refugees, you know, who also came as a, you know, relocated by themselves here. And of course, we also have a wave of the asylum seekers and asylees, so that we also serving. But it's about 18,500 was the number that we have been last year that was served about 40 years here. But every year we have about 600 people that we serve in Maine.
And
together with the refugees who came as a primary refugees from the overseas directly to Maine, and also people who is relocated from one state to another state.
And lately, in recent years, is there a country or two where most of the refugees arrive from?
For about last 3 years, the largest number came from Iraq, and then the second largest Somalis. And we can ask why it's happening, because they are already a Somali community living here and they have a family. We are helping them also reunify with their families who's abroad. So there are people from, we serve people from Burma, from Sudan, from Russia, from Iran, and from Congo right now. But it's a very small number if compared with refugees from Iraq and Somalia.
Now, when a refugee arrives here in Maine, I'm hoping you can talk a little bit about what status that person has. That person is not a United States citizen.
No. So when just right before they come, first of all, the whole the process, just Sally said, as then they approve by the USCIS, the next step will be their clearance of securities and their health screening and etc. When they are ready to fly, or before actually, many months before, as soon as we have approval from the USCIS, we receive their bio documentation through the State Department. We have to be accepting these cases as a local entity that we're going to work with them. So we send assurances and verifications to the State Department, and we assure the case. And it's just hanging on the website that we go and see every day. We have to go and look at every morning to see who is coming. So, and you know, every week or so, we see that arrivals that will come in the next 10 days or 2 weeks. And at that point, we start preparation. I assign case managers. We know the bio about these families. We know who they are coming, what languages we have to prepare the interpreting, and then we have to look at the housing, and if they have a family here, we're going to meet with the family, and we're working so hard to make sure that the core services that the State Department puts on us, mandatorily to meet with them at airport, and provide housing, and support with the welfare, enroll in the school, support with the employment, and et cetera. That's what we do as a case management. But upon arrival, they have I-94. It's actually the funny paperwork that was before, small paper, that allowed them or show them what is their status in America, which is with the stamp says it's refugee under 207 immigration law, and they are indefinite time, they can leave and work in America. So that's their refugee status. And this refugee status will be able to change to the permanent resident upon 1 year of being here physically. And they have to apply for that. And after 5 years, they can apply for citizenship.
So after 1 year, you can apply to be a legal permanent
holder. Yes.
Green card holder. And then an additional 5 years, you can apply to be a citizen.
Yes, from the
additional four years.
So it's 5 years from the time of arrivals.
Tell me a little bit about the support that refugees get when they get to the United States. I'm interested in that. The federal benefits that they are entitled to, and also the kinds of support that Catholic Charities of Maine provides separately.
So as I just mentioned before, this is the case we receive from the State Department, and this is actually called a reception placement fund that we receive in the beginning, helping refugees. And the reception placement program, it is a private-public program that's actually a federal government program, and we are kind of partnering in this, being as a private partners with the government. So we have to make sure that we have in-kind donations, that so many Mainers are so generous. They send us money, they send us, you know, furniture, used, you know, their clothes, and et cetera. We give this to our refugees. And also our thrift store that Catholic Charities has in Portland and other places that giving like vouchers for them to go and buy whatever they need. But upon arrival, State Department allocate $925 per person one time, like lump sum money. That money is given not directly to refugees upon arrival, but it's given to the Catholic Charities or any refugee resettlement as reimbursement. We have to reimburse, actually. Send the vouchers and they will send us money back later. So that money is actually designed to support with a first pocket money, as just we're giving to refugees, helping with the security deposit, with the housing rent, with the first food, kind of hot food we have to provide, and buying the beds and etc. That's what their necessities. And as you know, $925 is not much money. It just goes like that. And then they are entitled, or eligible actually, for the federal food stamps, federal cash assistance, and also Maine Care or Medicare, up to 8 months. But if you have a family with children, they are allowed to access for 5 years in a lifetime in Maine. That's the whole the support. And of course, we support like case management and support that social services. But of course, ultimate goal, being self-sufficient. And that's why we have employment services. We support our refugees to obtain the job and being self-sufficient here.
How quickly would the kids get into school?
So there is actually the time frame for each of the services. For example, within 5 days we have to intake. Within 2 weeks we have to apply for the benefits and, you know, for the social security cards. About 30 days we have to make referrals to the schools, because the kids has to also go through the health screening even here locally. having only international is not enough for the school system in here. So we have to refer them to the public nurses, which is state public nursing, and they make the TB test and several other vaccination before they can go to the schools. So it takes about 30 to 40 days to be enrolled them in the school fully.
You have an interesting job. I mean, you go, you meet refugees at the airport.
I do.
You have a
case managers, yes.
A piece of paper with their name on it or something.
Yes, we know that what's arrival time, what is their names, and no pictures, of course, but we know they have the special bag with the IOM, which is International Organization for Migrants or Migration. So that's the entity, it's an international kind of organization that they have contract with the State Department to allow or help refugees to travel from one point to the another point, I mean, final destination in the United States. So we will see that IOM back in their hands, and we know that these are people.
And then you get in the car and you drive them to the apartment where they live now.
Apartment, sometimes it could be hotel. We used to have here temporary housing, we call this welcome house. But it was really difficult to have welcome house to maintain. So we found the best deal with the local hotel in Scarborough, actually, and which has a kitchen and everything. So they can stay for a few days or maybe 2 weeks, and that's the time when they will move to their permanent place. But housing is an issue here.
Can I ask you a silly question?
Sure.
I suspect that when a refugee family is being dropped off at this hotel that has a little kitchenette, that the refrigerator probably isn't empty.
No.
What's in the refrigerator? And your staff have stocked the refrigerator.
So, you know what? Of course, we have to look at what is their religion, first of all, where they're coming from. So we have to make a culturally appropriate food choices. We also provide the hot food at the night when they come. So we buy from the local restaurants, you know, it could be Iraqis or Somalis or whatever restaurants we can buy. And the next day we go with them to buy all necessary basic food that important for, I mean, that will be, they will take this until they receive the EBT card with the food stamps.
When you think about the refugees that you've welcomed over the years, again, that's a pretty unique thing. A lot of us have not done that. Is there a kind of reaction? I mean, what do you see in people's faces?
I don't know. It's just really difficult to describe, but it's a very unique experience. You know, first I think they scare. It's terrifying, and then relief, and when you just... I never forget one time I just met a lady, one of my first refugee cases that when I start work here, a very old woman, about 80 years old from Somalia, and she came alone with escort. She was escorted by IOM personnel. And when she met me, because I have been allowed to go to the place where we can see them before actually the oldest and changes in the airport. So, and when I met her and she thought, you know, she started to kiss my hands, and that's what I never see that in my life. It was just very strange for me. And then her family came and they just told, that is just one of the custom in our culture, that because you are one of the person who meet her first, and you know, and she think that you are the big boss here, and she just really greet you. And you know, it was really interesting to see how she was happy to see her family. And you know, family when they're reunifying, that's an unbelievable experience.
Charlene, we'll have time to come back to you with questions, but first, if there were one misconception about the refugee process that you could...
I think that one of the important things that we should all know, that the refugees, when they come here, there is no free tickets for them here. They have to pay back the ticket or whatever, you know, pay for the travel. They sign the promissory notes that they're going to repay back all the money for their flight. And just imagine, if you have a family of 14, just arrived last month from Somalia, woman with so many children, and her husband was killed. and she has about $17,000 debt on the time of when she comes here. So I just explained, just wanted to bring this. People are paying back their money. There is not, like a special time, you have to pay this in 6 months. So you have to pay this, but you have to make all attempt to pay your money. If you are not paying back, there will be consequences. So the collectors will put on you that collections. And so it's sometimes really hard. But the positive things that about over 80% collection of the or repay of the travel loan, that's just amazing. And people paying back. And there's also no free cars. We never give free cars.
No free car. Carolyn, thank you. We're going to come back to you with questions. Barbara, I would like to ask you to start off by asking you, it's been a dozen years or more that we've been hearing a lot about refugees arriving in Maine, here in Portland especially, and in the last few years especially, we've been hearing a lot about asylum seekers here in Greater Portland. And you are our immigration lawyer. And I'm wondering if you can describe what's the difference between a refugee and an asylum seeker.
What's happened to refugees and asylum seekers is the same thing. They've had to leave their home countries because of the dangers that Sally spoke of. But the route that they take coming to the United States and coming to Maine is very, very different. Refugees have been processed thoroughly and sometimes for many years before they ever set foot in Maine. But a person seeking asylum has to find their way to the United States first and then ask for safety and protection once they get here. That makes them an asylum seeker. It doesn't yet make them an asylee, however. As Sally mentioned, people who are refugees have often been gathered up by the UNHCR in refugee camps. What she didn't mention is that they may be there for years and even decades. The process to come to the United States as a refugee has many, many steps and stages in it, many screenings, any one of which can, your case can fall apart and you can sit. There's a new book just out called City of Thorns that gives you a wonderful idea of what it's like to live in the Kenyan, the IFO refugee camps for years through the eyes of several different people there. Asylum seekers have to find a way to get here on their own, and they will get here any number of ways. Many of them will enter perfectly legally on visas that they've gotten from a U.S. embassy. Others will find a way to come to the United States without anybody noticing. We call them EWI. They entered without inspection, usually over a land border, one way or another. Others will come here in a particular status, and that's limited in time, and as that status begins to expire, perhaps something has changed back in their home country, or perhaps they simply realize that they are in extreme danger if they return to their home country. They then apply to immigration for asylum. We have narrow definitions of who is an acceptable asylum seeker and who can get asylum. Some of our rules come to us through international and global treaties, much of refugee and asylum law that, as it's practiced in the United States, is because we've signed on to international treaties and promised that if somebody is seeking refuge or asylum, that they will be allowed a certain amount of process. An asylum seeker only becomes an asylee when asylum is granted to them. And this is often a long and difficult road. First of all, the asylum offices in the United States are, and Sally can disagree with me, if I think they are understaffed. And because of that, once you get here and once you file an application for an asylum, you can wait 2 to 3 years before you'll actually appear in front of an asylum officer and have your case heard and perhaps decided. Meanwhile, if you really are in danger back in your own country, your family may be back there. They may be in equal danger. And the wait that asylum seekers go through is often very stressful, because only once they are granted asylum can they petition to bring their family members to join them in safety. The other thing you need to know about asylum seekers is that a lot of them will go through a period of time where they have no actual legal status at all in the United States. They will fall out of status. And this is an aside that Hayden didn't ask about. But of the many, many supposedly 11 to 13 million people who are in the United States without legal status, a large hunk of them had legal status at one time and lost it because it expired or some of their circumstances changed. Asylum seekers often have to go through a period of having no status at all before they are able to file their asylum applications. They have to do that in the first year they're here. And then a much longer period where they're waiting for a decision.
Barbara, thank you. What is the actual process of applying for? I mean, is it a government set of government paperwork to fill out? Is that what my asylum application looks like?
Yeah, it's got a lot of pages to it. You have to do it in triplicate or quadruplicate, maybe even more, depending on your family sizes. You fill out a large application and send it to a central office. That office will look through it and do a lot of processing. They will send you back a receipt that shows they received it. Once you get that receipt, after 5 months elapses, you can get a work authorization card that allows you to get a social security number and to work, which is enormously helpful while you're waiting.
I want to ask you about that. That was much in the news here in Maine, I guess a few months ago, that asylum seekers aren't eligible to work until a certain period of time after they file their application. If I'm an asylum seeker, I'm going to feel really tempted to just get that paperwork in as quick. Just fill it out, send it in, so I can get to work. What's your take on that?
That's completely understandable, and many people do that. They very quickly file their asylum application. The problem is, and I know I'll sound like a lawyer here, but the problem is that it's very hard to win your asylum case, and many people are unsuccessful. One of the things that's likely to make you file a successful asylum application is how much thought you put into it and how able you are to back up your actual story with objective evidence that supports what you're saying happened to you is in fact what's going on in your country. Immigration will not just take your word for what your situation is. They will also want to see objective documentation of country conditions and other experts' opinions and things like that. The more thoroughly you can support your asylum case, the more likely you are to be successful. At our office, if we're preparing an asylum case for someone, it will take us 3 or 4 months to do it in a way that we feel is really likely to succeed and really thorough.
In your opinion, that's the smart thing. If I need to apply for asylum, I should wait and have the lawyer help me.
No, I don't think that's a luxury that many people have. We don't have enough lawyers in Maine who are willing to work for very low, for low fees or no fees, and who are interested in taking an asylum case. We have some wonderful lawyers who do that. At our office, we have a panel of over 100 lawyers who have agreed to take a pro bono asylum case, but that still isn't enough to satisfy the demand.
At the risk of asking about vocabulary, I know that you'll humor me on this. A moment ago, you were talking about individuals with no legal status in the United States. I feel like other people would have said illegals and left it and used that terminology to refer to those same people. You don't use that terminology.
We don't. It's, first of all, it's pejorative, and as Sally has said so eloquently, we really have a huge amount of respect and compassion for our clients and don't particularly like that term. And it's also not quite precise enough as far as we're concerned. If a person is in the country out of status, that's a civil violation. That's not a crime. It's as if you forgot to file your taxes by April 15th. That's also a civil violation. You're expected at some point to rectify that, but it's not a crime. You're certainly able to mess up or to do things around both your taxes and immigration that are bad enough or fraudulent enough so that you can elevate them into a crime if you really want to. But generally, being out of status is just that. And people move in and out of status all the time. People who are out of status often find laws that allow them to get back in. And people who are in status will fall out of status.
Let me just follow up on that, because from time to time you'll see on the news that there has been a raid at a workplace here in Maine, and you'll read in the paper that a certain number of people are being detained in Cumberland County Jail. So that feels like a criminal. That feels like criminal. I take it civil detention. There's not tea at 4 o'clock or.
Well. Yeah, you don't want to be in civil detention. It does exist, and immigration is a good example of it. What Sally does is one department of immigration, but there is another department that's immigration enforcement. They are responsible for just that. They have their own police, have their own court system, and they have the ability to detain people who are out of status. The downside from a lawyer's point of view of somebody in civil detention is that they don't receive some of the same protections that a person in criminal detention receives. No court-appointed lawyers, not a whole lot of due process necessarily. You can be in civil detention without really being charged with anything other than being out of status, kind of indefinitely, if nobody knows you're there and you don't speak English and you don't have a lawyer that goes in and makes a fuss.
Thank you. Barbara, last question to you. If there were one misconception about all of this stuff, about the refugee process, about the asylum process, if there were one misconception that you could correct, what would it be?
This isn't exactly a misconception, but I would like to push back just a little bit on the melting pot notion. I think that's an old standby that we sometimes use when we think about our country. And I have found, as a person that lives in a very secluded, you know, stuck up there state by itself and has lived in New England all her life, that the idea of cultural mosaics works much better for me. That when asylees and refugees come here, they are not an empty slate waiting to have America write on them. They bring with them an enormous amount of history, depth, and experience, and culture, and we should all enjoy having it around us a little bit more rather than wishing that it would go, you know, kind of all blend in.
Barbara, thank you. We now are going to, we have plenty of time. I'm going to start, as the guy with the microphone, I'm going to exercise the privilege to ask the first question. And this is to the three of you. So I've read recently in the newspaper about state governors writing a letter or otherwise expressing themselves to the federal government that they will not accept Syrian refugees into their state. Our own Governor LePage has said that, this is a quote, he will take every lawful measure in his power to prevent settlement of Syrian refugees in Maine. My question is, Well, Barbara just kind of answered under her breath. So, Barbara, I send this to you. My question is, what are the limits? What are the limits of a governor's authority around, or the extent, however you want to frame?
I'll lead in with the law school answer, which is immigration law is federal by definition. The states have a very limited ability to control federal immigration law. They have the ability to do things like say, we won't give driver's licenses to people except in this state. You know, they can control what they can control on a state level, but largely they cannot tell the federal government what it can and can't do.
This question is, I think, in particular to you, Barbara. So you mentioned that the asylum person, if it takes so long to get asylum, but yet they're in this holding pattern, how do they support themselves? How can they go to work? What happens to them?
The services they can receive are much more unpredictable and dicey. During the time it takes them to file for asylum and then wait out the 5 months before they can get their work authorization card. Once they have a work authorization card, that allows them to work, and there could easily be another 2 years before they have their asylum hearing, but they have that card during that time, which is helpful.
What is the difference between, you've described two categories of people. What happens when it's just a straight immigration story? Is the process still the same?
Can you clarify just a little bit by what you mean if someone is neither a refugee nor an asylum seeker?
If they're just coming here with proper documentation and want to become an American.
Sure. Well, refugees come here with proper documentation by definition, but there are also vast numbers of people who come here through other processes. Usually they will either have what's called a visa, which gives them a fixed amount of time that they're allowed to be in the United States and a fixed purpose for being here, or they will be here as legal permanent residents in order to live and work in the United States. And often those folks have come here through family members who are U.S. citizens who have brought them here, or employers who have sought them out because they have special skills and brought them here.
My name is Jean-Claude Gassana. I would like to ask about the immigration lottery.
I don't know what exactly you are looking for, but it's every year, the USCIS, I believe, right? Is it their program or a State Department? Actually, State Department program.
Yeah.
So it's a State Department program. And that allow about 55,000 people to be chosen from the all the world, from the whole, the globe. So within October 1st until November 4th of that year, people will, enter through the website of State Department, and they put their names and, pictures and answer the questions, and they just hit the button, just go. And so you will participate in the lottery. So if you are lucky enough, you can get this, win this the lottery. But then you're going to start for the processing. You may not be chosen even. Even you have won this lottery, but at the process at the embassy of United States overseas, they will go through your questions and then asking about your assets, because you have to show an amount of money or the wealth that you can support yourself here. Because upon arrival to United States, you promise the United States government you're going to take care of yourself. So you cannot apply for any federal benefits, for example, food stamps or main care or any cash assistance. You have to take care of yourself. You are lawfully living here with your green card.
Okay, and just one other thing to add to that. The countries where the diversity lottery is available is not every country in the world. It's specific to countries that are underrepresented of people trying to come to the United States. So it's a way to spread that out a little bit. For example, nobody in Mexico is going to be eligible for the diversity lottery.
My name is McDonald Johnson. I'm a college access counselor working with immigrants in Maine, helping them access higher education. My question is, an asylum seeker in the state of Maine is allowed to apply for social security and work authorization 5 months after their stay here. After they get it, they are allowed to work, pay state and federal taxes, but they are not allowed to apply for federal financial aid. So can you explain that?
And they're not the only group that's not allowed to apply for federal financial aid. The FAFSA, the federal financial aid form, is available, and we're talking just about Pell Grants now, so federally subsidized college grants, only available to U.S. citizens and people who are legal permanent residents, in other words, have a green card. What people are not excluded from are some schools have scholarships that are in no way restricted in that way. But that's what's available to people until they have a green card. Please don't think I agree with this rule.
My name is Jules, and I'm an asylum seeker. So basically, I'm coming from Congo DRC, French country. And I was forced to leave Congo because of the situation happening there. So moved to South Africa, 5 years, and I became a refugee in South Africa. Unfortunately, to get crushed on the jaw because of the foreigner situations recently, which happened last year. So forced to leave South Africa for the second time after 16 years of leaving my original country and move by getting another visa to the United States. So I have to reapply again as an asylum seeker again, even though I was granted a refugee status in South Africa. So that's the first situation. Secondly, you have to leave your kids after working in the senior level in a very dangerous country now, in a moment now, because of your origin as a refugee and as a non-national person from South Africa. So you got all those stress in your head. Because it's not easy situation of leaving your country first, going and find another heaven, and suddenly you have to be crushed again, and you have to pick up again and leave for the second time to try to find another second heaven. So we arrive in the United States, and we are forced to stay for another 5 months without any revenue, not work, and you got little kids remaining in South Africa. It's a lot of stress just to spend one night. This is just to get a work permit. So we feel ourselves like we become useless. This is what you sleep with it. So my question is, what are you providing to get us at least going on our mind that you can do something in the community while you're waiting for your work authorizations? Because this is a daily stress we got. That's the first question.
Thank you, sir.
I guess I feel as the representative of USCIS, I feel like I should explain the reasons why. There was a time when, in fact, when I was an asylum officer in 1996 to 2001, and it was just at that time, I think, and I think you probably would remember the date better, but there was a time when if you filed your asylum application, you would immediately get your work authorization immediately. And what started happening is hundreds of thousands of people started filing their asylum applications even without having an asylum claim and even without their knowledge of having filed an asylum application altogether. It was filed by what a notario So what happened is that the very limited resources that the agency had to hire asylum officers were overwhelmed by these frivolous applications for asylum. And so we weren't able to serve people such as yourselves. And so this regulation, is it a regulation or a policy? I can't remember. The regulation was changed, and Congress changed the law and required that people wouldn't receive a work authorization if they file for asylum unless their case was not adjudicated within a certain period of time. And so that's what happened. And then what you saw is you saw the integrity of that system change and become more righteous. And there was a considerable drop in the number of frivolous applications that were filed. Now, having said all that, certainly I understand how a lack of work authorization for legitimate asylum claims is problematic. But this is the reason why this regulation was changed.
Hi, my name is Jean Potacek, and I am a retired sociologist from the Lewiston area, so I'm going to ask a sociological question, which is, how does the resettlement process deal with the tension between, on the one hand, refugees and immigrants generally needing, their resilience depends on cultural supports of their home culture, and on the other hand, in the receiving country, particularly among the white population in the United States, there's a very strong desire to see refugees in particular and immigrants in general assimilate as quickly as possible, because although the melting pot may not be real, it's a very powerful story that white Americans tell themselves about who we are. So I want to know how the resettlement process deals with that tension.
So in our agency, we have an entire office within our agency. It's called the Office of Citizenship. And the principal objective of the Office of Citizenship is to facilitate the integration of newly arriving immigrants through a number of different resources and services offered directly to the immigrant, but also to service providers, such as Catholic Charities, for instance. And in addition to that, I feel that it's my role, in part, as the field office director for USCIS, to provide a friendly atmosphere where, for instance, naturalization ceremonies can occur in public settings so that white Maine, for instance, as you mentioned, can get a sense of the diversity and the value of that diversity in these naturalization presentations. And so it's a very integral part of our agency's operations.
We, as a resettlement agency, we have our mission and vision is to, first of all, to help refugees to be self-sufficient, self-reliant members of our community. And we are trying our best to help them to integrate and to really understand American life through the orientation, support system, and so on. And, you know, it's integration. It is not one day or 90 day, as, you know, State Department gives us 90-day core services. Within 90 days, you have to make certain steps to make sure that they have access to basic life skills, etc. But, you know, it's just a process. And sometimes people just living for all their life and they're learning. I am living here for 12 years myself. Every day I learn new English word, new something, you know, law, or et cetera, et cetera. So every day we learn something. And I think it's just for the human being, as a living being, to learn. It's a normal stuff. From other side, as a company that has this vision, we have also another important mission to outreach and also make awareness of the community to make them welcoming place for the refugees, where they can be welcomed and live in safety. Because, you know, people just came here. They left their country because of being unsafe place, where they've been persecuted, they've been killed, they've been tortured, and etc. You have to make that place where they feel really safe. And we try to do a lot of stuff. And, you know, our program are outreaching the universities, the churches, and, of course, through our church system, we're able to outreach to a lot of people. So we go to schools. We are going to the businesses, nonprofits, government agencies. We provide a lot of outreach programs, trainings. And one of them is very famous, called this In Shoes of Refugees. We simulate like a game that how the refugees leaving their home, where they're going, and how they hold the process. And, you know, the people who is attended that training, they've been really amazed what the refugees are experiencing. And really important for them to know. And then we just trying to educate people. That education is really number one. And that's what we are trying to do. And it's, of course, it's a big and long, you know, process. And that's why we are always looking for the private partnership with everybody who can come and really support us through the volunteering and doing a lot of great stuff for refugees.
And I also want to put in a plug again for anyone interested in this question. The terrific exhibit at Maine Historical Society really gives a sense of this tension between the people who are arriving now and the people who are already here. Maybe they just arrived the other day. That tension is not new, and it's been playing out in Maine over and over and over and over again. So another plug up the street, Maine Historical Society.
My name is George Budagu, and thank you very much for taking time to discuss about this matter. It's very important, and I thank you all for all your insights. I have one quick question for Sally, and you said you've been in the refugee camps, and I don't know which refugee camp, but supposedly in Africa, because I've been in one of the refugee camps too, and I was born in Congo, and you mentioned something about the cruelty of human being toward other human beings, in terms of, you know, probably committing atrocity, killing people and torturing, and but also being born in Congo and moving here, I've also realized something that I would call cruelty of human indifference toward helping other people. You mentioned about 20,000 million people, refugees around the world. And when you see the way we act toward solving some of the issues other human beings are facing, it's so slow and you get disappointed. And just to give an example, Canada has 23 million people, the last statistics I've heard. And it's bigger than the United States in terms of area. We have in US, we are more than 310 million. So if you take that 20 million and put it in Canada, you'd be like just putting a drop of water in the ocean. Why, what, and the question is that, what disappoints you in terms of acting toward finding solutions? What is the most disappointment toward finding solution quickly? The other question is, what changed? I know you're working now in one of the U.S. Government agency. And what changed for the last 12 years? Because I moved here in 2002. It's going to be 14 years now. And it used to be so quick to find an asylum. Or you apply an asylum, in 2 weeks you get a response, whether it's negative or positive. It was so quick. But now people are spending 5 years in just process of waiting asylum. You used to do that if you're going to the next level of a judge, that's where you used to take a long time. What changed? I'm sorry to take time.
I have to say that the most disappointing thing that I faced when I was in the refugee camps was not so much, the total devastation that I heard from refugees. It was actually the lack of compassion of some of my colleagues that worked in the refugee camps with me. So that was, it's even hard for me to talk about, because the one thing I don't understand is how anyone could look in the eyes of somebody who suffered so greatly and not show anything but the most compassion that they have in their heart. So that if there was anything that's disappointed me about all of my experiences in life, that is what disappoints me the most. As far as what's changed in the asylum process, I mean, it's really, I work for USCIS, and for the most part, I'm very proud of the work I've done with this agency and the colleagues that I have working in this agency with me, for the most part. But we're funded. Our agency is funded by the fees we receive from the people that file for benefits with us. And so we have to balance the fees that we get against what we think will be the demand. And then we have to allocate those resources depending on where we think those product lines are going to be the most, where it's going to be the greatest. In the last couple of years, 2 or 3 years, we've had, or whatever, however many years, we've had a tremendous, an overwhelming number of people coming across our borders from the south, the southern border. So we've had just a tremendous number of young people, primarily escaping gangs in El Salvador and Honduras and Guatemala. And when they arrive in the country, they have the right to declare a fear of return home. And once they declare that fear, then by law, an asylum officer needs to do a preliminary interview with them to determine if they might be able to meet that standard before a judge. And so that created a tremendous backlog for the asylum program. And it's a backlog that the asylum program has not yet been able to overcome with the resources that they have at our disposal. We're working hard, we're trying very hard, we're trying to do what we can, but unfortunately, because of the great demand and the limited resources, there's a significant wait time for people who have filed for asylum.
I have one thing. I think there's also been in the last few years an enormous number of upheavals in enormous numbers of places. I think overall, people seeking asylum, those numbers, those absolute numbers have gone up enormously. Interestingly, in Maine, the asylum seeking community that we see here is a very distinctive one and does not come from the 10 countries that send us the most asylum seekers. We have a wonderful community of asylum seekers from Burundi, DR Congo, Rwanda, Angola, Sierra Leone. We have asylum seekers from Djibouti. None of those countries are the top 10 countries for sending asylum seekers to the United States. The very number one country, what would you guess that would be? Of people in the United States seeking asylum from? Yeah, the top 10 countries, right, this is last year's statistics, are China, El Salvador, Guatemala, Mexico, Honduras, Venezuela, Ecuador, India, Ukraine, and Haiti.
I just, Barbara and Tarlin each mentioned that they work for independent nonprofit 501c3 organizations. The Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project, ILAP, is the scrappiest little organization you ever care to meet. There's so much heart in that office. And Catholic Charities of Maine is just doing such terrific work every single day of the year. If you have a mind to, either of those organizations are very much worth your support. I want to remind you, if you can, to fill out that evaluation. And I want to thank our panelists, Barbara and Sally and Tarlin, for being here and leading us in. And thank you all for coming.